series of Tuesday night presentations, when we've had folks from both the past and the present and the future of Holden Village talk to us about our anniversary and looking back to the way the place got started, all the things that happened, the miracles, and especially all the gifts that took place. And certainly one of the people, as you've heard me say now a couple of times, if you've been around these last few days, who knows most about that is Gil Burke. One of the few people that I feel I can honestly say that under God's grace, without people like Gil, Holden just wouldn't be here. And we're just terribly, terribly grateful for that. And glad he can be with us this week and share. And we're going to let him do whatever he wants to do in sharing this evening. We hope that you'll ask him not only questions about the past, but maybe also ask him questions about what he thinks the future of Holden can be and should be. And maybe he'll ask you what you think the future of Holden can be and should be. So, we begin with Gil Burke, please. Welcome him.
Oh, thank you. I'm quite surprised that there are so many people interested in the history of Holden Village in the Lutheran era. I'm in the process now of writing a book about it. I started this book several years ago and haven't found time enough to finish it due to illness in the family and the death of my wife. I had a couple of knees that I think I wore out here at Holden Village, and I had to have them replaced a year ago, so I've missed a couple of years coming up here. Otherwise, I've been here every year since the time I left the village in 1963. Well, my involvement started with a phone call. Isn't that quite strange that so many times parts of our lives are influenced by a phone call? In my case, I wasn't too surprised to get that call, because I was a member of the board of LBI at the time, and I'd been born into the Lutheran Church. If I hadn't been a Lutheran, I wouldn't have gotten that call. And I was active in the Lutheran Church all my life. I was engaged in many phases of the work, both in home and foreign missions. Had a deep interest in both of those, and church-related colleges and so forth, and fundraising and different activities. If I should tell you about my experiences in the Lutheran Church from the time I was born until now, it would take all night. And so I'm going to skip most of it. But I have been grateful to God, because he led me into this thing. It was one of the most wonderful things that ever happened in my life, to be drawn into this development when it began in 1960. As I said, it began with a telephone call, and a young man whose name was Randy Stein called me one evening and challenged me to become a member of an appraisal committee that would visit the village and appraise the properties here and make some recommendations to the board. I didn't take much time for me to agree to belong to that appraisal committee. And at 4:30 in the morning, the following Saturday morning, four strangers to me showed up at my home, and they were wanting to pick me up and take me along with them to Holden Village. One of them was Victor Nelson. I didn't know him before. I'd heard about him. And a man by the name of Adam, I had heard about him too, but I'd never met him. I had met Randy Stein through activities at LBI, but he was just a young fellow. And I hadn't had any association directly with him. He was a student there at the time. His father was president of LBI. And Earl Van Kirk, an electrician from Kent, Washington. And so they came to my home on the banks of Puget Sound, and in a few moments we were on the way. In my book account of this meeting with these fellows, I go into some detail how we became acquainted and how we came from, belonged to different synods and different churches, and that we had a lot in common in many ways. And that occupied some of the time on our way to Holden Village. I'm going to skip a great deal of what took place between my home and the lake. But you're all acquainted with the beauty of Stevens Pass and the Tumwater Canyon. Now, many of you probably have never been there, but it's quite a treat. And just the way to Holden is an interesting thing to come up on the boat and to be treated to so much of God's beautiful scenic, the beauty and all. It's quite an experience, isn't it? Well, we came up on the boat that day. I'd been on that boat before, many years previous to that. And this place was not a stranger to me because I had people working here that were friends of mine. And they had kept me informed, and then several times and invited me to come up here, and I hadn't taken them up on that invitation. But I was very anxious, and I looked forward to going up the Railroad Creek Valley in an old car with a great deal of anticipation. And we arrived here about noon, about 1 o'clock on that day in early June. It was a beautiful day, and as we drove into the village, I right away saw something that I was going to be interested in. It was a tremendous experience for me to sit on the porch of house number one and view the village and the mountains and all that God has created in this beautiful wilderness area. I was much taken by it. And as I was eating my lunch, I hummed the tune, "My God, How Wonderful Thou Art." And that was my introduction to the city of Holden Village. And it was a ghost town, really a ghost town. It had been abandoned for 3 years completely and then some. And you can imagine what takes place in the wilderness like this during 3 years of abandonment. But there was some light in the village. We were the only human beings in the village that day, and it was a strange feeling. But we had some company too. We had a lot of chipmunks running here and there. And I think they were really excited because we were in the village. And I think they were disturbed because we disturbed them. First thing you know, we discovered part of the fire alarm system in one of the little hose houses there, and it had a triangle in it, a shape like this with an iron thing, and in that little house there was a beater, an iron beater about so long, and I picked that up and beat that triangle, and you should have seen the chipmunk scurried up for cover. And we broke the silence that day, which was terrific. The only sound was the rushing waters in Copper Creek and Railroad Creek as they rushed through this area. Otherwise, everything was quiet. But there were signs that there had been a lot of activity in the village. There were deer tracks everywhere, and there were we could tell, too, that there had been horses in the village, and they had stomped on the lawns and the lawns, of course, had been unwatered for 3 years, so we found them to be brown and pitted, and they were in sad shape. Well, after lunch that day, and we had a wonderful lunch, we carried our lunches with us, and we had a good time just sitting there on the porch before we attempted to start our appraisal duties. We had a great time thanking God for the privilege of coming into a place like this and having a part in maybe developing something that would be new in the church. And so after lunch, we walked into house number one. Today they call that the Gilbert Chile, and I've been grateful for that, although I don't think I earned that honor, because there were so many people involved in developing Holden. But right away we discovered that house one was built like it would have been built in a city where there were tight restrictions. It was built to the code exactly, and better. We inspected every room in that building, and we finally sat down on the porch and discussed what we had seen, and we thought that maybe this was a sample of what we would see in the other houses and the other buildings, the quality that was in there. The lumber was number one. It had been taken out of the forest and sawed in the company's own sawmill here. The joists and the piers and everything was number one grade of Douglas fir. And the spacing and the nailing and everything was up to code. The wiring and the plumbing, the heating, and everything that we discovered that day was up to the code. And we made notes in our books about how wonderful that place was. You should go through that building to see what a nice building it is. Then we looked at number two. Number two isn't here today because it burned down it must be 10 years ago now. It burned down, and that was a sad day when that beautiful building burned down. It too was, if anything, it was nicer than number one, because the people that had lived in it were really good citizens. They had kept it clean, and they hadn't left much junk around like we had found in number one and the other buildings on the cul-de-sac. Then we took number three. That was a bachelor's headquarters. It was, you can just imagine how dirty that was. That had quite a number of rooms. It was a tremendously good building, but the people that had lived there had lived like dogs, really. And they had left tons of rubbish, magazines and boxes and everything else. And of course the mice and the rats had been in there and lived there for 3 or 4 years, and they don't exactly make a place smell very well. And when we left that building, we indicated that, boy, that building needed a woman's touch. There were bachelor quarters. Then I'm not going to bore you with our walk through the rest of the chalets. We found them to all be in well-built. This is what we were looking for, well built. There was a lot of damage. There were broken windows and chimneys that had fallen over on account of the heavy snow here that hadn't been shoveled away from the chimneys. And as we looked over the village that day, we saw the bricks lying in the road by the hotel where the chimney there had fallen down and punctured a hole in the roof and the whole bit. And so we right away learned that there was quite a bit of damage that had been done by the heavy snows. But surprisingly enough, this village was so well built, and the pitch of the roofs and all was so wonderful designed that they were designed to shed the snow when it got to a certain depth. And consequently, there was very little damage in most of the buildings. And as we walked through every room in all of the chalets, we discovered what kind of people had lived in there. Those buildings had been occupied mostly by the engineering staff and the office people of the mining company. They were fine people, but some of them weren't extra good housekeepers. And what they left behind on the day of Exodus was considerable. There were truckloads of junk in those buildings, boxes and newspapers. Sometimes there would be 10 years of newspapers in each of the buildings. And so we right away determined that we would have some job to clean those places up when the time came. And when we finished with the 14 chalets, we walked over towards the hospital. And on the way there, we discovered a half-eaten deer on the pathway. And that told us that in this environment, there are a lot of deer and there are cougar. And they had feasted on venison just a few hours before we arrived. Well, that was an introduction to the animal world. And of course, the tracks that they left in the village was something. Deer tracks and bear tracks and every kind of animal, and lots of chipmunks, of course, and rats and mice and so forth. And we went through the hospital, and there we discovered that it was a very wonderful hospital building, and we gave the House on Mining Company big marks, good marks, for having provided such a fine facility in a village of this kind. And there we discovered that there were a lot of records, and there was a lot of pills, and many of the supplies that they used, they had left behind. And the operating room was quite a discovery. And if that table in there under those bank of lights could have talked to us, they could have told us a great deal about the medical history of this village. And we, of course, surmised that there had been people that, in spite of the fine environment here, there had been illness, and there had been people born here, and people had died, and some had been killed in the mine. And history was really written, and the medical history of the village was really there in that building. And then we took in the dormitories, 1, 2, 3, and 4. We crawled under the buildings there to see what the foundations were like, and we discovered that they were beautifully done, that it was in every respect a good building. And we walked through all the rooms in all those dorms, one after the other, and we discovered that there was beds in each one of them and a chair or two, and the need for a great deal of cleanup. There was dust and mice tracks everywhere. And of course, when they had left, many of these buildings hadn't been repainted for some time, and they required a lot of house cleaning and painting. But we were really pleased, and right away it indicated to us that there was capacity there for housing a great many people. And next we took in the hotel, and there we had some surprises. We walked in the back door. We had to crawl over all the brick that was laying there due to the fallen chimney. And we walked into the dining room. No, we walked into the cook's room, an apartment first of all. And there we found a table with thousands of keys on it. There was a heap as big as this centerpiece here, and it was stacked high with the keys that belonged to all the locks in the village. And every lock and every door in the village was unlocked. So the people that came here, they could go through these buildings, they could take what they wanted during those 3 years. And we talk about the danger of fire today, and it's a big danger here. And here the village had stood with no attention whatsoever for 3 years, wide open to everything, and the keys were right there. This told us something. I mentioned this in the book that I'm writing and what it meant. And I thank God for the fact that he had his hand in this village and preserved it for our use. And in the dining room, the tables were all set as though there was, it was just before dinner time. And on the day of Exodus, the dishes had been placed on the table, the silverware and all was there, except some pieces that had been stolen. This was quite a surprise. And we inspected the kitchen, and the kitchen was a mess. The chimney had fallen and broken the roof, and it had leaked, and the dust had come in, and there were was an awful lot of dust, and the oil ranges were covered with a coat of grease that you wouldn't believe. It took the forerunners a whole month to clean out just the kitchen. And I'll tell you about that later if we get to it. And the hotel rooms were a mess too. They were very dirty, and but they were furnished. There was a bed and a table and no blankets on them. We later found the blankets, and I'll tell you about that. And then we went into the lower level where the store now is, and all the storage rooms and the offices and so forth. At that time, they used that mostly for storing food stuff. And there were barrels of flour and cereals and boxes of cereal and canned fruits of all kinds they'd left behind. And of course, this had been a paradise for the rats and the mice. And they had scattered cereal all over that whole lower floor. It was a mess. And it didn't smell well. And we could hear the rodents in the walls and in the dark places as we walked through there. We walked out onto the loading ramp, and there we discovered that the slides from the roof had come down on that little shed roof, and it was standing like this. And we right away knew that one more year of that and that would collapse. So we took note of that and decided that we'd have to shore that up before winter came if we were going to take the place. It wasn't decided yet, you see, that we would accept this gift, the surprising gift. Then we walked over to the big recreation building. We walked in the side door there where there's a copper indentation there with showing the elevation of the building, of the village, to be 3,206 feet. And then we passed on down the stairway to the barber shop. And that was in fairly good order, but the barber had left a pair of scissors behind on the day of Exodus. Evidently, he had been in a hurry. Then we walked into the pool room. Have you been in the pool room? Yes, well, those tables were there, and I think there are some additional tables now. And the one-armed bandits were there, and we inspected those. And they were in working order, and they had some dimes and nickels in them. And in Washington State during that time, it was against the law, you know, to have those things. But up here in the village, evidently they had a law of their own. And so they had these one-armed bandits. And the bowling alley was not in very good shape. But the balls and the pins were there, and we were thankful for that. And we inspected the heating plants and the toilets and the washrooms there, and of course we expected that there'd be a great deal of danger there because of the freeze. At the time they left the village, they had drained the water system, but they hadn't blown the pipes out. And so there were a lot of low places in the pipes everywhere throughout the village that had frozen, and the pipes were broken. And we anticipated that there would be a lot of that. And later on we discovered there were hundreds of leaks in the village. The recreation building was a surprise to us. We walked into that gym and right away I could see what a potential for a place to play and a place to worship. Surprisingly, the benches were scattered all over the place. Hikers had been in there and lived there overnight, and there was a barrel in the center of the floor, a 50-gallon drum with a top cut out. And that had all the evidence that they had built a fire right in the middle of the floor there in this barrel. And we talk about being careful today. Well, the people that were here during the time of abandonment surely weren't careful. And it's a marvel that the place didn't burn down. And we also went up to the second floor where we found to our surprise, how wonderfully that building is built. We right away determined that it would have cost $500,000, even in those days, to have built that building. The steel arches in that building are tremendous. And that building is so well built that it could stand a load of 10, 15 feet of snow and not be harmed. And it hadn't been harmed. There was no damage whatsoever to the building when we walked there, except in the snack bar. That had been vandalized. Some of the equipment had been pulled out, and the windows were broken, and there was dirt everywhere. It was a mess, and we are determined that it would cost quite a bit to restore that room. And then we walked over to this building. At that time, this was a dormitory. And this has been remodeled. You can see what has been done here. This was opened up, and this Quanania room was developed about 1965. And it's been a very useful place. And they, of course, that reduced the bedroom space in the village some, but not to a great extent. And dorm number 6 at that time was mostly, the ground floor was a store. The mining company operated a store there. And they had a meat market too. And they had a walk-in freezer that was about 10 by 10, as I remember. And that was stacked from floor to ceiling with the blankets and pillows that the people had left behind. And they were valuable. And I'm sad to tell you that before we came back in the spring, after having been up here that year, they were all gone. A pack train had come over from the west side and taken every blanket and every pillow. And of course, the people that visited the village, the ghost town village during those 3 years, they had also helped themselves to a number of things, like some of these chairs. I found some of these chairs down at resorts along the lake, and pillows with House on Money stamped on them. And a lot of people came up here and helped themselves. It was wide open, and it was a surprise to us that more hadn't been taken. And then we walked up the road a bit, and we investigated the firehouse, the chief firehouse. And in that was a little old fire truck. It was really a comical thing. It had been here since day one, but it had a lot of good equipment on it, and we were thankful for that. And all these little fire stations you see here, that equipment was today is just the same way that it was 27 years ago. That hose and the equipment that's in them, it was all there, and it was in wonderful shape. We walked to the ball field. We had borrowed a car from a man at Luzerne, an old pioneer there. He let us use our car, provided we would check on his horse up here. And he didn't know exactly where we would find it, but he wasn't allowed to rent it to us because the lady that had the resort there had the rights to take the people on this highway, an exclusive right to haul people on the highway. And so he had to be very careful about not renting it to us. But he says, if you'll take a check on my horse, well, you can use my car for 2 days. And later on, we used not only his car, but his truck too, and he was very generous. He was one of the great contributors to Holden Village, and he had a great hand in the early development of the village. We then checked the ballpark, and that was quite wonderful. There's where we found the horse. And the horse raised his head and took one look at us and resumed feeding. That was all the interest he had in us. He was fat and sassy and real in good shape. And we inspected the stands, the grandstand. There was some of that left at that time. And that, too, was something that pleased us. And also, there was some remains of the hoist that had hauled people up on the heights in the wintertime for skiing. And we were pleased about that. But we weren't so pleased to walk into the miners' village. This was a village built by the miners. There was 60 of them. Now, there's some controversy about how many there were. There's people here will swear up and down that there were 100 of them, but I counted them, and I counted 60. And so that's what I'm telling you. And half of those were caved in at the time we walked into the village. Because they had been built by the miners, they hadn't expected to be away during the winter, and they were present to shovel the snow off. And the roofs were not steep enough to shed the snow, so they had to be shoveled. And of course, with no one here to do that, many of those buildings just collapsed under the tremendous weight. You just have no idea the weight of the snow that falls here. Many times there'd be 6 and 8 and up to 10 feet of snow, and it'll rain between time, and it'll settle and freeze and pack, and it becomes tremendously heavy. I can show you beams up on the mine level that are I-beams that are this heavy, that have bent under the weight of the snow and ice. And if you took the roof off a building up there, these steel buildings that were so well built, if you took just one sheet of roofing off, it was enough to allow the snow and the ice to build up within those buildings enough to collapse them. That's how heavy the snow is up here. So we determined at that time that we wouldn't have anything to do with a miner's village. It would be an impossible thing to restore it. It would be impossible to bring it back to where it was. And the constant care and the care in the wintertime, they were built to withstand the pressures. It would be impossible. We right away determined that this is something that we should forget about. The forest would have to worry about that. And the first night here was something. We returned from the miners' village just before dark. It was just light enough for us to find some chairs and some mattresses to put on the floor in house one for our sleeping that night. And we hadn't had anything to eat since lunchtime. So we were hungry, and we didn't have anything to cook with. So we rummaged through our sacks and found enough to survive during the night. And that was quite an experience to sleep on the floor there that night. And before we went to bed that night, we thought, well, we'll go out and see what it looks like after dark. And it was the most beautiful thing that I think I've ever seen. It was pitch black, and the buildings and the village was hidden. It was just in a canyon, see, but we could look up and see the blue sky. And the mountain tops were etched against that blue sky, and we could see those, the rims and the peaks and the whole thing, and it was something that would really touch you. And we gave the Lord a lot of credit for a selling job on us that night. And we walked out and saw millions of stars between the mountains, Mount Copper and Buckskin. That canyon is so beautiful. And I can tell you at this point that in 1961, when the foreigners were here, there was no light in the village. And they were treated to sights like that at night. And they used to sit out there on the benches and whatnot and just look at that sky. And when we got lights in for the next year, they were really disappointed because, you know, a light can often dim the beauty of something that's completely in the dark. So, and then we went to bed that night. We were thankful for what a wonderful day we'd had. And we had learned a lot about the village, and we were quite enthusiastic about it. But we had seen a lot of things that disturbed us too. But we went to sleep, and it was about 11 o'clock. And within an hour or so, I heard some noise. And I knew that wasn't anything that a human would make. And so I took my flashlight and looked over on the floor, and there was a rat about that long. It had a tail about so long. It's a pack rat. And it was dragging my shoe from my mattress across the living room floor and into the fireplace. When I put the light on it, it just stared at me for a long time, and after a while it resumed and dragging my shoe. Well, the fellowship we had as a group, these men that I met that morning, they proved to be tremendous fellows. And they were good companions, and we had a lot of fun in doing what we were doing. The breakfast that morning under the trees, that morning it was frosty. In June here, June mornings are frosty here. But we had bacon and eggs and pancakes and the whole bit. And my companions there noticed that I was not drinking the coffee. And that we only had one can to cook, and they had taken that and used it for their coffee, and that left me nothing. I had to drink just water. And so there they accused me of being a poor Norwegian because I didn't drink coffee. And they said that during the day it was going to be a hard day and I would run out of gas because I hadn't had any coffee in my tank. Well, that morning, Sunday morning, was just another beautiful day, something like today. It was just beautiful. And we then walked up to the footbridge and we spent some time there. We were quite intrigued with that footbridge. It was beautiful. The one that's there now is new. But it was a covered bridge, and it was artistically made and designed. It was very well done. And we stood on that for a long time and looked at the Copper Creek flowing under it. It was in the spring, and the river was high with a lot of water. That's not a small river, not as you see it today. It's at its low time now. And we saw the auxiliary equipment there, auxiliary pumps, both in electrical and gas driven. And so the mining company had provided for a lot of things here that you wouldn't expect hardly. And we went through the mill building, and this was a revelation. We knew nothing about milling ore, but we speculated a great deal that day about how the process was. And I'll skip that because I don't know enough about it. But we figured it out pretty well, at how they did it, how they dumped the ore in at the upper end of the building, and how it had gone through these different flotation tanks with chemicals and all, and air and so forth, and separated the gold and the copper from the bare rock. And we had a pretty good understanding by the time we got through. And then we went up on the mine level, and there we saw equipment that the wrecking crews were using. You see, the House on Mining Company had sold the steel in the buildings to a company that, a salvage company, and they were in the process, but they were out of the village that weekend, and so we didn't get to talk to them. And we saw rails, cars on the rails there that led to the mine, and they were loaded with rails that had come out of the mine. So we knew they were working in the mine at that time. They had wrecked some of the buildings at the mine level already, but now they were working in the mine. And you know, there's 55 miles of tunnels in that mountain up there, and there were a lot of rails. And that was an easy thing to take out, but they had to use manpower to do it. There was no electricity in the village. So, we went to the mine entrance, and we took a walk inside as far as we could, as long as we had some daylight. And we determined that tonight would be interesting if we could keep that mine open for people to go in there. It's quite an experience to go into a mine like that. Later on, the next year, when the Forerunners were here, we took the whole group in there. And that's another story. But and then there were other buildings up there, the main office and the machine shops. And those, the machine shop and the compressor building had been wrecked. And all that was left of them was the foundations and just tons and tons of debris. And of course that was left for us to clean up if we were going to take over. And we walked through the mining company office that hadn't been destroyed. The lower floor of that was filled with all kinds of equipment that had come out of the village, refrigerators and beds and a thousand and one things. It was a tremendous amount of stuff that wasn't worth very much. It was too old. And we walked into the upper floor from the outside, and there we found all the records of the mining company. They were just the way they walked out of there and left everything behind. You just wouldn't believe what we found in there. Most interesting. And of course, a lot of those records we preserved in order to put them into the archives and whatnot. And then we inspected the water tank. That 75,000 gallon tank up there. And that was in good shape. That was very well built. There were, I think, one valve that was frozen. Otherwise, it was so well insulated that all the valves except the one had been preserved. And we walked up to the top and looked into the big barrel there, and the water was coming in from the intake from above, and there was a pipe running out of the tank that took the overflow, and that was pouring out on the hillside below us. That water system really intrigued us. It was such a wonderful system, and the water was so wonderful, and it was worth millions in our estimation. We walked to the water the intake dam in the falls. Have you been up there? Any of you? You should walk up there if you have a chance. At that time, it was in real good shape. It was quite a sight to see that water coming down the canyon Copper Creek. And the intake dam there is not a very high thing. It's just high enough to divert the water into the pipe that leads to the tank down below. That level is 500 feet above the village, and so there's considerable pressure there. Since that time, there's been a new dam built 200 feet higher up to divert the water into the hydro system. And of course, at the time we were here, we also discovered that the transformers were all gone up at the pad there at the mine level. The wires had been cut, and the other end of the wires were 40 miles away at Manson. And so the village was without any electrical energy whatsoever. But we saw possibilities for harnessing that creek up there and the water system to provide the power. And that later took place here. As you can see, we have the lights now. That's all hydropower. We temporarily put in two CAT diesel units. On your way to the footbridge, you'll see it on the right there. Those units are still there. And they served for a couple of years before we installed the hydro plant. And they're still usable. In emergencies, they can be used today. They're integrated with the other system. So, we found other buildings up there. I won't stop to explain what we found up there. There was a lot of buildings. One of them was the powder house, for instance, that had housed hundreds of tons of dynamite throughout the years in the mining operation. Afraid that there might be some powder there. Well, we found two boxes of dynamite and some caps. I wasn't so afraid of the dynamite, but those little devil caps are really something. I had learned as a boy that those caps were something you want to avoid. And they didn't belong there because the doors were wide open. People could go in there and drop one of them and blow their heads off. And there were bunkers up there. Many of them were too far gone to salvage. We found the service garage up there that had been built to service all the trucks of the mining company. That was in good shape. And later on, we nearly lost that because the wrecking crew thought that belonged to them. But I stopped them just in time one day when they had started to take the roof off. And and that later burned down. That was another loss that we've had in the village. So we are aware of the fact that fire is a tremendous danger up here. Well, that was practically the end of our tour. It took us until 1 o'clock the following day to inspect the mine properties and assess them and make notes on them. And of course, we spent a lot of time looking at the huge pile of tailings up here, which will be a problem as long as we live, I'm afraid. But we went back with some mixed feelings. I think some of the men that were with me secretly thought that this could be a big white elephant because of the stupendous job it would be to restore it. I didn't feel that way. I didn't see anything that we couldn't overcome. I was so optimistic. I wanted to believe very much that this was a place that we needed. And all I said to myself was, if I can talk to the people at headquarters in Minneapolis, the people to bring up here and let them see what we have here, and if they think they can use it, why, we can overcome anything that we have seen. And we went back feeling that way. The next phase was to develop a corporation after we determined that it was feasible. And of course, in the meantime, I had made a lot of trips to Wenatchee to talk to the Forest Service and to the POD who operate the electrical system in this county. And they were were very gracious and offered to restore the power lines, but we couldn't depend on that. We figured that 40 miles of transmission lines would be too much to service over the years, and we figured that we would have to have our own lighting system. And the Forest Service, we talked to them, and that was one of the things that disturbed me the most, was we didn't know whether or not the Forest Service had approved this gift to Holden Village. And we knew that they had to approve it because they owned the ground on which this village stands. The mine properties are in our name. We have deeds to that. But the village is built on Forest Service land, and they, of course, you can't operate here without their permit. And I had dealt with the government enough to know that that's not an easy subject. And this could really be a white elephant if they hadn't given us a permit. And when I took Dr. Rieke with me to Wenatchet, we met with the Forest Service that day. That was a big day in my life, because we met people there that were just as anxious to see this thing go as we were. And this was a huge surprise to me. I'm sure that those people were Christian people, or they wouldn't have had the attitude that they had. And it was a marvelous relief to me when we left the Forest Service that day, and they said there would be no problem for us to get a permit, provided we do certain things. And of course, they would let us know what all that had to be, and that was plenty. But if you do what they say, they're nice people to work with. Well, the next phase was to, after we determined that there was hope and a chance that we could restore and it was feasible and the studies were over, well, then it was a matter of organizing to develop program and to develop teams that would do the restoring and to get a constitution and the legal papers that were necessary to carry out all the legal things that had to be done. And in time, this was accomplished. And this was a tremendous experience. Everybody we talked to was willing to have a hand in it. I just had never experienced anything where everybody was so positive. There were a few. I remember one pastor. We took a lot of people up here to see this place before we decided to go ahead. And amongst those was a pastor. He said, "This is a huge white elephant. Don't ever touch it. You'll never be able to do it. Don't try it." But there weren't many people like that. They were positive. And we developed committees and a development council, and we had deeds to the property to from House on Mining Company to LBI, who determined should accept the gift and hold it until we knew what we really wanted to do. And this worked out beautifully. And it was all done in 1960, before the end of that year. The next year was a restoration year. And we had then developed contacts with the youth departments of the various synods, and they had come into the picture. I knew that it wouldn't be possible to touch or make or communicate with the headquarters of these synods, but only through their youth department. I knew some of those people, some of the leading ones. I didn't know Elmer Witt at the time, but later learned to know him and love him for what he has done. And so that was a development year. And that's a story in itself. This was a beautiful story, and I'm trying to put this into book form so that people can read about it. Not just a factual thing, but I'm trying to bring some of the real instances where we had a good time together and what we did as a unified group of Christian young people and old people and every other kind of people. And so I don't know whether I should get into that, because it's a big phase of it. And so if you've got any questions, I'd like to answer those. What would you like to hear about most?
What was the Exodus? What was the cause of the mining leap? I didn't know anything about that.
I cover that in the book briefly. But I'll tell you this, that the price of copper had gone down, and the cost of production had gone up, and the cost of mining had gone up because they had taken out the best copper and ore-bearing, the gold and ore, copper ore-bearing ore. And the rest of it was deeper and farther away, it would be more expensive, and they couldn't reconcile this with a profit-minded board of directors, and they decided to close it down. And they advertised this place for sale for the 3 years, and were not successful in getting anyone that the Forest Service would approve. And that's how they happened to give it to LBI. And LBI was the proper one to get it, because what they did for this was beautifully done. Their spirit was really good. You can't say enough about what LBI did to make this a going thing. There were some of the people there that thought that maybe LBI should promote the program and do the restoration and the whole thing, but they didn't have the money and the know-how to do that. And it had to be a national situation. It couldn't be on a Washington, or it couldn't be another Bible camp. We have plenty of those in Washington. It had to be something that the whole country would be interested in, the whole world, in fact. And that has proven to be correct. You know, that an awful lot of the people that come here, a big percentage of them are from the Midwest and from California and from all over, and even from Europe. So it has a constituency that's widely scattered. And the Exodus came suddenly. The people that lived here were frightened to death. They lost their jobs, and the miners lost their homes. There was no chance to sell them. And many of those homes, they had put quite an investment into them. They were nice, and the gardens were nice, the rockeries and flowers. It was a beautiful village at one time.
Who owned the individual miners' homes? Did the miners themselves?
The miners owned them. They built them, and they owned them.
On company property.
And when we came up here, when they heard, many of those miners heard that we were going to take over, they offered to give them to us. But we didn't want them, because they're no value to us. The materials to take wreck those buildings and salvage that material, it wasn't worth it, see? Good materials, but, you know, wrecked buildings don't provide a good material for restoration. And there were a lot of lumber up on the mine level. Just thousands of feet of good lumber up there, and timbers of all kinds. And we salvaged all of that. And all the plumes that were up there that through which the tailings were sluiced down into the valley there, that had an awful lot of good lumber in it. We salvaged all of that.
What did they do with the hospital?
The hospital just cleaned it up and painted it. It was in good shape. That was one of the finest buildings up here. And I don't think they've done any renovation other than that up there. We painted the rooms and cleaned them. We first of all broom cleaned all this village. We hauled out truckloads of debris and burned them. And then we got down to washing and restoring and fixing pipes. There were hundreds of leaks in the village, and every time I go into the dining hall, I think of looking up at that ceiling, and there was water coming out of every one of those tiles almost when we turned the water on. And that was quite a job. And there were 800 broken window panes in the village that had to be restored. The schoolhouse was vandalized. It was ink. They had left 5 gallon cans of ink in there, and somebody that headed in for their teacher evidently one time or another went in there and just vandalized that schoolhouse. They poured ink on the floors and the ceilings and walls, and it was an awful shed. But no structural damage.
Where did the name Holden come from?
Pardon?
Where did the name Holden come from?
From the original prospector. His name was J.H. Holden. He came up here in 1887. He was and a railroad engineer came in. They were looking for a passage over the mountains, the railroad engineers, and they discovered that there was an outcropping of ore on the Copper Mountain. And that's how that got started. And Holden was the original owner of that claim. And he is now gone, and some of his family have been here over the years, and a lot of the miners that worked here have come up, and I understand now this fall there's going to be about 160 of the miners that worked here during those years are going to be here on one day. Yeah. You can just imagine how those people love to live here. They had bonuses here that you couldn't find any place. They had good jobs, they were well paid, and they had good homes. And the people that lived in these hotels and the cottages here, I heard so many stories about how the diet in that kitchen, the dining room was something like a logging camp. And if you've ever been in a Washington State logging camp, you'll know that they eat the best in the world. They had steaks and everything, anything they wanted. That's the way they could keep miners, to feed them well. And we copied that the first 3 years I was here. I told the cook, boy, these people are coming to work. They're going to have food. It isn't going to be soup and salads. It's going to be meat and potatoes and vegetables and everything else. And we fed heavy those 3 years. And people that came here, they wanted to come up here just to eat. I'm not finding fault with the diet today. I guess that's all we need. But the people that work, we played hard and we worked hard. And we did everything hard, and it required a lot of coal in the boilers.
Gil, I was wondering, did the Forestry Department level and clean up the miners' camp then after you took over?
No, the Forest Service didn't do that. That didn't belong to them. That belonged to us.
Oh,
and we did that.
Did you?
We spent a good many hard days up there with trucks. And the first year we were here in 61 with the work parties, all the equipment we had was one truck. And that's still in service after 27 years, number one. And it's but a relic now, but it's still in use. And we hauled the people up here, 75 at a time sometimes, workers and visitors. And the next year we had a bus and another small bus. And so that's the way it started to grow. We had no cranes or any working equipment. We had no backhoes. We had to do everything by hand. We skidded the diesel units that weighed tons off the truck and onto the foundations that we had built for those two units. And you can imagine what a job that was. And the same with the hydro plant. We had to take those units out of Idaho and bring them up here. And by the way, those hydro units didn't cost the village a penny. And if you were to buy those today, they would be worth an awful lot. And much of this equipment, much of what you see here in the village has been contributed. The organ, for instance, and the chimes, and the bell, and many things that are valuable in here have been contributed by people. We had some farmers come up here that were challenged by what they saw and what we were trying to do, and they offered to buy trucks and deliver them without any charge up here. Wealthy farmers from Eastern Washington, some of them had 5, 6, 7,000 acres of wheat and range. And they were challenged to do some of these things. I can name a lot of things that have been contributed. A pastor came up one time and I took him for a walk. And I took a lot of people for walks through the woods after supper in the evenings. And up on over the tailings and up to the falls and up to the mine level. And there we picked them up with a truck. And when they come back, they're in good humor. And many of them saw what we needed and they come forth and provided it. There were trucks and buses and a lot of things. A pastor from Michigan came up here. He fell in love with this place. When I took him for a walk, he said, "Gil, what could you use $4,000 for?" I said, "Well, we could build a powerhouse for the hydro plant." He says, "It's sold." He says, "We'll have you a check. When I get home, I'm going to challenge my congregation to raise $4,000. And in a couple of weeks, we had it. And that provided the means to build the powerhouse. And I could go on and tell you about the contributions of hundreds and hundreds of people that you just wouldn't believe. They just loved this place, and it was so easy to challenge them. And this ministry was really meant to be a ministry of sweat and dirty hands. That's what built it. And we worked hard doing it. It was a wonderful experience. I can't tell you enough about it. And if you get a chance to read my book when it gets finished, why, do it. You'll learn all about it. Any other questions?
What is the estimated value of the Holden Village property now, would you say?
Well, I tell you, we tried to estimate that at the time, and we set it up on our books at about $1.5 million. And of course, that was 27 years ago. And the dollar was worth an awful lot more at that time than it is today. I don't know just what, I would say that it's worth, well, property like this isn't something that's easily sold. You can't appraise it on the basis that you would appraise a house in the city where it can be sold. But we appraised it at that time about $1.5 million, just to have something in the books. But there are things up here that you don't appraise in terms of dollars. They're priceless. This environment is priceless. You come up here and you just fall in love with it, don't you? And if you have a program here to match it, and everything else matches the environment, it'll always be something great. But this place will not continue without the interest of a lot of people. It costs money to operate in this wilderness. And who knows? There might be another fire, and the replacement costs up here are tremendous. But if the Lord took care of it during 3 years when there was all kinds of opportunities for a fire, he'll probably look after it from now on, too.
Yeah, I think we'll let the people go on their way. I hope that you will take time to chat with Gil while you're here, in person, too. The place is called A Surprising Gift, and Gilberg is a reliable gift. Just a great gift to the village. That's testified not only by what he did, but what he continues to do, by his loyalty to the village all through the years. As he said, except for the last 2 years, he's been up here every year since he left, and that's a long, long record. Total reliability. It's a good confidence that grows out of his faith, too. I hope you buy a surprising gift, but I hope you wait and get Gil's book, too. We're going to encourage him to keep working on it. We'd love to see that book in print, too. Thanks very much for coming.